This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Why, yes, that was Henry Paulson you saw taking a victory lap. The former Treasury Secretary couldn't help but remark upon the news today that 10 big banks will repay their TARP bailout money. The TARP was Paulson's baby, after all, but the bailout, it's still having some growing pains. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, offering breaking news, exclusive stories, and insights that impact today's financial markets. More at newsfirst.reuters.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here on this Tuesday. It is the 9th of June. Recall back in October that then-Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson met with the CEOs of 9 of this country's biggest banks. He told them in no uncertain terms that they had to take the TARP money to save the whole financial system. So they did. But they only learned later that the money came with some terms and conditions, you might say. So the race has been on to give the bailout back. Today, 10 big banks got permission to do that, although almost 24 smaller ones have already. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now from Washington.
Over the past 7 months, the 10 banks paid the government nearly $2 billion in dividends and interest to borrow Treasury's money. President Barack Obama says that means so far the troubled asset relief program is turning a profit.
We're restoring funds to the Treasury where they'll be available to safeguard against continuing risks to financial stability.
But William Isaac at the financial consulting firm LECG Global says the banks that are returning the TARP money never needed it, and it didn't do them any good.
Except cause them a lot of consternation and to be dragged through public stress tests and be criticized for sponsoring golf tournaments that they've sponsored for years and other such things. It really has been a lot more harmful to those banks than helpful.
The banks that got permission to pay back the bailout performed well on those government-run stress tests. But the congressional overseer of the bailout, Elizabeth Warren, today questioned whether the stress tests were stressful enough. For example, she said the tests assumed an 8.9% unemployment rate. And last month, unemployment was 9.4%.
This is a real concern. The worst-case scenario right here in 2009 is, in fact, not the worst case. We're going to see worse numbers than that.
At a separate congressional hearing, Treasury Secretary Geithner said the tests imposed other, more rigorous standards, similar to conditions during the Great Depression. He said the tests and the TARP money helped improve consumer confidence in banks. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Late this afternoon, the Supreme Court changed gears on the Chrysler bankruptcy. After a 24-hour freeze, the court ruled Chrysler's sale to Fiat can indeed go through, that over the objections of some of Indiana's public pension funds. The whole episode, though, led us to wonder whether it was ever possible for Chrysler creditors, like those funds, to hold out any hope for a better deal. Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll reports.
Indiana State Treasurer Richard Murdoch's beef with the Chrysler bankruptcy is pretty simple.
For 150 years of American law, being a secured creditor meant that if there was a bankruptcy, you were first in line for proceeds. In this case, All of that has been overthrown.
And Fiat, which hasn't invested a dime, will own 20% of Chrysler. Meanwhile, Indiana's pensioners will be paid 29 cents on the dollar for their investments in the troubled car company. Murdoch and others have doubts that this is really the best deal possible.
I hate to say it, but I just don't see Fiat as being able to offer anything that might be of value to Chrysler.
Jim Cashman, an auto industry expert at the University of Alabama, is a Fiat critic.
Number one, it probably has the lowest quality vehicles in Europe. Number two, it has no money.
Given time, Cashman believes other buyers would have emerged and made offers for Chrysler's strongest brands, like Jeep. David Skeel, a bankruptcy professor at the University of Pennsylvania, agrees.
Frequently, in big bankruptcy cases, there are three, four, five different reorganization plans before one finally gets confirmed.
But in this case, the only bidder was the U.S. government, and they backed the Fiat merger. Now that the Supreme Court has cleared the way, Chrysler hopes to complete its sale by the June 15th deadline. Meanwhile, the car company continues to lose $100 million a day. I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
For those who've been hoping there's an economic recovery in the wind out there somewhere, one word today: gas. Oh, and oil. And yeah, all right, that's three words, but you get my meaning. The rise in pump and crude prices is raising some fears about that recovery. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
It's true that crude prices jumped 3% today after the Energy Department bumped up its forecast for world oil demand. It's the first time it's done that since last September. But try to hang on, America, because some experts are hopeful that pump prices might be close to topping out just as soon as commodities investors get a little gas bubble out of their system. Oil trader and industry analyst Stephen Shork is among a growing number of market watchers who argue that demand is still too weak to justify this new round of price speculation.
A lot of the fundamental guys are saying oil belongs in the $40 range, and you get all the technical guys, guys that look at a bunch of lines on a couple of charts and said, oh, you know, that's a moving average and so forth, and that means that's bullish regardless of the economic reality, and they continue to pile money into the market. The market is effectively being hijacked by a bunch of technicians.
Shark is worried the speculators risk weakening the economy even more, and at MoodysEconomy.com, energy specialist Chris Lafakis agrees there's cause for concern if higher pump prices stifle consumer spending.
If you look at not only the amount of jobs that have been lost, but the slowing in wage growth in recent months, consumers are in a much more tenuous position this summer than they were last year.
On the other hand, Lafakis thinks that's exactly why gasoline and oil prices won't go much higher, because quite simply, they can't.
We believe the level of demand is sufficiently weak right now to take the edge off pump prices.
Indeed, AAA says gasoline prices failed to rise overnight for the first time in 42 days, and the Energy Department is now forecasting gas will peak at $2.70 a gallon sometime next month. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, no peaks, no troughs either, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Four months ago, there was much hullabaloo over the looming switch to digital television. So much hullabaloo, in fact, that Congress and the White House agreed to delay the transition. The new deadline is Friday, this Friday, and Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports that still not everyone is ready for digital prime time.
Do nothing before June 12, 2009, and you could lose your TV signal.
The Federal Communications Commission has been warning viewers for 2 years about the conversion to digital TV. It was supposed to happen in February, but the government pushed back the date when it started running out of $40 vouchers for digital converter boxes. There are more vouchers now, thanks to the federal stimulus bill, but the FCC's Mark Wigfield says millions of Americans are still stuck in the analog age.
The latest Nielsen figures show that about 2.7% of the nation's households are completely unprepared.
That's about 3 million, and it includes the elderly, the poor, non-English speakers, and of course just plain old procrastinators who will swarm Best Buy Thursday night in search of those set-top boxes. The FCC has hired thousands of people to staff help centers and take phone calls from the TV-deprived. One analyst noted, at least American Idol is over. True, but the NBA playoffs may not be. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Today we're going to pick up with our series, Taking Stock, occasional conversations with people who can give us the long view of our current economic situation. There aren't many people around today who can give us that perspective better than Anna Schwartz. She's 93 years old, an economist for more than 60 of them, still working every day at the National Bureau of Economic Research in New York City. Her area of expertise is monetary policy, how much money is in the economy, usually controlled by the interest rates that the Federal Reserve sets. Specifically, she's an expert in how the Fed blew it during the Great Depression, when customer after customer pulled their money out of the banks.
The Federal Reserve could easily have provided additional money supply. That would have helped the banks that were losing deposits, and that would have helped the economy in general.
46 years ago, Schwartz and a guy named Milton Friedman, who'd later go on to win the Nobel Prize for Economics, wrote a book on that topic. It was called The Monetary History of the United States. It's on just about every list of the most important books on economic history ever. When I sat down with her in her office in Manhattan last month, she made it clear she's none too happy about all of Washington's bailouts or how the Fed and the Treasury chose who got one and who didn't.
I think both Bush and the Obama administration have not been as hard-headed with the banks. It has been too lax. And instead, if they had said, if you cannot raise capital in the market, there is no reason for the government, the people of this country, to provide capital.
Okay, but wait a minute. Didn't we try that with Lehman Brothers last September? And there are people who will say that only made everything worse. Should we now say to Bank of America and Citigroup and some of these other banks, hey,
no,
you can't make your loans? Tough.
The trouble with the way the Fed operated when it rescued Bear Stearns, the market then believed this was a signal of the way the Federal Reserve would perform. If the Fed and the Treasury made a candid statement to the market, we will help a bank which basically is solvent. We will not do that for a bank which is on the verge of bankruptcy. And then the market understands there are principles. That's why when Lehman Brothers was permitted to fail, the market was simply bewildered, because here you had treated Bear Stearns in this kindly fashion, and what reason was there not to do the same when Lehman Brothers arose?
Now, do you think the market has figured out what the policy of the federal government is toward these rescues by now? It's been 6-7 months since Lehman Brothers.
The market is just bewildered. Bernanke came into office insisting that the Fed would be much more transparent than it had been in the past. But I don't believe that it's lived up to that. If the market understood what the Fed was planning in each case and could see a design, then I think the market would have reacted much more positively.
It sounds like you're frustrated with Chairman Bernanke and the White House, that they maybe haven't learned the lessons of history that you and Milton Friedman wrote about.
Well, I think that that's a fair statement. Considering Bernanke's background, you would have expected a much more, well, should I say, a tidy kind of performance by the Federal Reserve. Seemed to be something that was ad hoc and introduced without considering all the implications.
You know, Alan Greenspan was lionized in this country for many years.
Right.
And then a year ago went up to Capitol Hill and said, you know what? I blew it.
Yeah.
Does he get the appropriate amount of credit and or blame for this whole thing?
Well, I think the verdict of history will be different with regard to his stature than it has been so far.
In your mind, these toxic assets, the bad assets that these banks still have on their books, are they still a big problem, or have they worked their way through the system now?
No, and I think the big shortcoming of the Obama administration and the Bush before that was that it didn't make a concerted effort to get rid of these assets. I mean, in a sense, it's a condemnation of the Federal Reserve. They did not respond to securitization, which is the basic condition for the creation of these toxic assets. Neither Alan Greenspan nor anybody else at the Fed seemed to be concerned.
Securitization, that is, the buying and selling of these packages of mortgages, there are those who will say it contributed a lot to the economic growth in this country.
Yeah.
Do you buy that?
Well, I suppose the people who made money on it will say, sure. But you have to be able to divine what you're letting yourself in for if you're going to permit securitization to go on. And nobody took action to say, wait a minute, what are we doing when we're permitting these mortgage companies to issue these securities backed by a pool of mortgages of varying quality, and you don't know how to price the security? Nobody raised that question.
When an economic historian comes along in 25 or 30 years and tries to do for this episode what you and Professor Friedman did for the Great Depression, what's their verdict going to be on the monetary policy that the Fed has been following?
Well, there has not been a straight line in programs that the Fed has introduced over this period. So I don't know whether the verdict will be charitable. It's always possible to find reasons why other alternatives were not really available. But I think on the whole, the performance has been disappointing because now, 2 years and more after Bernanke came into office, we don't see visible signs of change for the better.
Dr. Anna Schwartz, she's an economist with the National Bureau of Economic Research in New York City, has been since 1941. She's also the co-author with Milton Friedman of A Monetary History of the United States. The archives for our series, Taking Stock, are online at marketplace.org. Coming up in London, making movies, but not making friends.
They're trying to pull the wall over our eyes by making it into little Venice and Rome and having that as a concept.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials basically flat for the second day in a row today, edging down just 1 point, finished at 8763. The NASDAQ climbed 17 points, nearly 1%, closed at 1860. The S&P 500 gained 3 points. That's a third of 1%, ended the day at 942. Texas Instruments lassoed a 6% gain today after the nation's second largest chipmaker raised sales and profit forecast. Men's Warehouse was up 13% on good earnings news, but Eddie Bauer fell 50% today, 5-0. That had been rumors the outdoor clothing company is going to seek bankruptcy protection. The government listed 10 banks, as we told you, that are in a position to repay their TARP bailout money, but only a couple gained in the stock market. American Express charged up 5%. BB&T Capital One each gained more than 2% today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Super Brands, Brand Week's annual ranking and analysis of America's top 2,000 brands. You can Google Brand Week Super Brands for more information. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Statebook for events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for April. A Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee holds a hearing on how government assistance affects the automobile industry. And a discussion at the National Press Club addresses depression in parents and its impact on kids. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Obama spent some time yesterday talking about his economic stimulus package, how many jobs it's already created or saved, and how many more are coming. Almost every part of the economy, it seems, got money in the bill, including the National Institutes of Health. They'll get that money out into the economy in the form of research grants, which sounds pretty good, but might not actually add jobs. Paul Baskins with Chronicle of Higher Education, he wrote about it today. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
All this stimulus money that's out there, is it doing the expected and attracting just a whole bunch of scientists who need grant money?
Well, it's doing that. The question is whether it's doing what it's expected in terms of getting jobs created is one thing, but it's certainly at this point attracting a lot of interest among scientists.
Can you quantify it for me? How much money is at stake here and how many applications above and beyond the normal?
The stimulus bill was $787 billion, and of that, there was $10.4 billion that was given to the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, which is the agency that hands out money largely to universities to do scientific research, but the NIH is the largest in the federal government that does it. And last year, the NIH had about 77,000 grant applications from scientists. This year, the number is up from 77,000 to 115,000, and that's due largely to the money that was given to the NIH through the stimulus money.
What about those universities, though? Are they kind of banking on this money to help them fund, obviously, scientific research, but other avenues of science and academic pursuits?
They are. As a matter of fact, there was a long period during the Bush administration when the NIH funding, again, that's the main source of scientific research funding going into universities, that was pretty level during the last five or so years of the Bush administration. So the universities have really been looking forward to this bump up. So partly what was talked about at the NIH meeting yesterday where they went over some of these numbers was the fact that they're seeing some evidence that universities were kind of treating it, as one described it, as a lottery, where they were just saying, okay, put in any application you can. There's all this money out there and go get it. And the NIH reviewers, or actually the officials in the NIH, were a little concerned by that. They certainly do want to see a lot more interest in a lot more good projects being funded, but they were a little concerned that the increase was so large it was reflecting, you know, more cases than really had a reasonable prospect for being funded.
Does it necessarily hold, as the Obama administration was banking on, that more money for scientific research will get better science out there? I mean, certainly there are more grant applications being made. Are we going to see better science out of that?
We'll have to see, but it's certainly good reason to expect that. The question, I think, also is whether we're going to see a large number of jobs from this, because remember what the whole point of the economic stimulus bill was, to create jobs. And in this kind of funding, it's a little questionable as to how many jobs you're really creating, because what you're doing is basically giving money to university researchers who already have jobs there at universities. They may buy some new scientific equipment, but a lot of cases that scientific equipment may have been made in another country. So there's been some criticism, or at least questioning, as to whether this kind of spending is a jobs-creating mechanism. But then again, they will also point out that when you spend this kind of money on research, what you do is you get spin-offs and you get companies that are formed. And, you know, if you hit the next Google or whatever, maybe that alone will create thousands of jobs.
Paul Baskin, he covers science for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Paul, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You've heard of Hollywood, of course, and Bollywood probably too, India's movie industry based in Mumbai. But what about Pinewood? It too is part of the film business. It's a studio about 20 miles outside London. It's been kind of a mini Hollywood since the 1930s, turning out movies like Day of the Jackal and Phantom of the Opera. Now Pinewood's got plans to expand out into the surrounding countryside, but the neighbors claim that, like everything else in movie making, this plan is not quite what it seems. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Sprawling across 100 acres of rural southern England, Pinewood is already big. All the Bond movies were made here, along with scores of American blockbusters, Dark Knight, Wolfman, and The Bourne Ultimatum. But Pinewood's group director, Andrew Smith, says he and his colleagues want to expand. They've bought another 100 acres of nearby countryside, and they're planning what he calls a visionary project.
What we're looking to do is to build a living and working community for the creative industries, and this will be the first of its kind, well, we think, in the world, actually.
The plan had a cost of $300 million to build up to 1,400 homes for movie workers, cameramen and carpenters, set designers and the like. These homes will then double as a film set. They'll be arranged in a series of permanent street scenes available as a backdrop for movie making.
We're building 16 streetscapes, which will replicate your typical street in Paris, Prague, Berlin, Amsterdam, Venice. There are street scenes from New York, Boston, New Orleans and San Francisco.
He says the project will save money and the environment. There'll be less need to fly film crews to different locations around the world. That will cut Pinewood's carbon emissions. But the plan is not going down well with the locals.
Could I have a pint of Strongbow cider and a pint of IPA, please?
In the Black Horse pub in the neighbouring village of Fulmer, there's almost total opposition. Pub manager Kay Keane says the landscape around the studio is designated as Green Belt. That means it's legally protected with strict curbs on building and development.
Green Belt is Green Belt. You cannot build on Green Belt, and it should never be allowed.
She says Pinewood is in the business of creating illusions, and this project is just another one. She believes it's a sham, a way to get round the Green Belt planning restrictions and make a mint out of the real estate.
They're trying to pull the wall over our eyes by making it into little Venice and Rome and having that as a concept.
You think this is just a residential development project?
That's all it is.
Come on, Arthur. No, Arthur's coming. He's coming. Come on, Fred.
Ronnie Lamb, calling his two pet donkeys. Ronnie is chairman of the local parish council. He says no one could possibly object to Pinewood building its street scenes. The problem is then populating them permanently with up to 4,000 real people.
The major concerns from the locals, who actually like Pinewood, is that we're going to have a huge development where the local roads are simply totally unable to cope with that level of traffic.
Back at Pinewood, the studio is quietly confident that it will eventually assuage local concerns and persuade the authorities to approve the plan. Movie making, after all, is a lucrative and highly popular industry.
Good to see you, Mr. Bond.
But Pinewood, scene of so many staged confrontations, must know that it now has a real fight on its hands. At Pinewood Studios, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a brief detour into the world of credit default swaps, and I promise it'll be brief. Turns out, if you believe the folks who trade those corporate insurance policies, that bonds issued by Campbell's Soup and Intel might be a safer investment than Uncle Sam. Right now, it costs more to insure treasury bills against default than it does debt from Campbell's and Intel. Before you get all worried, though, it's not that the market is betting on a default by the government, but figuring debt levels against revenue streams and paying for the bailouts. Some corporate balance sheets just look a whole lot better than Washington's does. So at least we'll all have warm soup and computers if something goes horribly economically wrong. Till then, though, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost a point. We'll call that flat. The Nasdaq dropped 17 points, nearly 1%. The S&P 500 rose 3 points. That's a third percent there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeed. Coming up next time on this program, charting a new path toward giving.
I really don't know if people are going to say, hey, my $25 goes further in South Sudan or in Cambodia than it does in, say, Queens, New York.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.